This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need reminders of the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, we had hoped that they were going to be the views of Jonathan Gray for the next hour, but we haven't been able to reach him. Jonathan Gray, of course, from New Zealand. We've had some wonderful programs with him. The last program we did was a two-hour coverage of the history of the world from the time of the Noah's Flood up until the time of Christ's birth, and going into the very secret societies and mystery religions and their influence on the thought of the people during that time. And we'd hope to be able to, of course, pick this story up and bring it up to the present time. However, I'm afraid that Jonathan is not available, so I'm just going to, do a dissertation and hope that you will call in. It's going to be open lines. We've got Jonathan Gray on the line. Oh, that's great. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Very well, thank you.
I almost had an apoplectic shock. You know, I was afraid you weren't going to be here, and I was going to be doing a two-hour monologue. So I'm so glad you could be with us.
Yes.
And last time we talked, we talked really about the history of the world, beginning with the Noah's Flood and then taking it on up to the time of the birth of Christ and the secret societies, the mystery religions, the forces, the secret forces which really shaped the world during that time. I think, of course, as a prologue to getting to the secret forces that shaped the world in which we live today. So, do you want to pick up there? I noticed you have a new book out on the secret knowledge. I was intrigued. I tried to get a copy of it before the program, but that sounds like another fascinating subject for discussion, because there really is secret knowledge. There are secrets out there that are unknown to the average individual, and I'm sure that your thoughts on this would be a very, very parallel to mine. But can we sort of pick up the story? Now, you know, the evolution of history from the time of Christ on up until the present time.
Yes, I'd be very happy to do that, Dr. Stan. And perhaps just a little bit of reviewing from last time may help to put us all back into the picture again before we move on further.
You go right ahead.
Okay. We go back to the time of the Tower of Babel when a group of people left their original landing spot where the ark had landed, and they moved through the mountains to a great plain, and there they decided that they would be far enough away from Mr. Noah that they wouldn't hear his preaching any longer, and they would set up their own way of life. And we know the story of the Tower of Babel and how God confused the language and how Nimrod ultimately was executed for his idolatry. We did cover that.
Yes,
and how his widow, Queen Semiramis, in shock, was not to be beaten, however, to retain her power and that of the priests that had been working with Nimrod. She offered herself to them in exchange for them perpetuating the story that Nimrod was the promised savior who had been promised way back in Eden, and that he was the one who had benefited the people. Enemies had wrongly murdered him, but that and his spirit had gone to the sun. But that a beam from the sun had impregnated her womb, and she was the promised virgin mother, and that her son would be Nimrod, reincarnated as her, or resurrected as the one who would ultimately rule and defeat his enemies. And that was the beginning of the sacred mystery.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you go right ahead and pick this up from there, because, of course, there was always this secret power that was always available. And, of course, this, when we look at the Statue of Liberty, what does the Statue of Liberty represent? Well, some people think that it represents Semiramis, and others, of course, think that it was Diana. But certainly the Statue of Liberty, at least as far as the occultist who put it up, and remember, of course, that it was a Mason who designed the Statue of Liberty. It was a Mason who put out the architectural design for it. It was a Mason who built the pedestal there in New York Harbor it rests, and they raised the funds for it. The Statue of Liberty, which represents certainly a pagan goddess, having nothing to do with the liberty of America. It's symbolic to those of us in America as a symbol of liberty, but not to the people who designed it and put it up, because it represented the ancient mysteries and these ancient fables. But go right ahead.
Yeah, these mysteries, of course, spread worldwide, and you mentioned a couple of names there, Dr. Stan. Well, these names were used by the pagans depending upon their language, and all the way across the world on all continents, the mystery religion of Babel was dispersed by the scattering of the people, and they took this false religion with them, which was really contained in some of its elements a corruption of the original prophecy given to mankind that a savior was coming, and they mythologized this savior in the person of Nimrod, and eventually lost sight of that part of it, but kept on worshipping a goddess and her husband and her child as a pagan triune group, and it was a counterfeit of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and his promised coming. However, there were still people among the nations who believed that the Messiah was yet to come. And these people actually were in harmony with what the scriptures revealed relating to the coming one. We have 300 prophecies in the Old Testament relating to the coming Savior, which were fulfilled, of course, in Yeshua, the Jesus Christ coming into earth. And we must bear in mind that this is not just a human development. What we have here is a battle, a war, a very fierce war to the end between Lucifer, who was cast out of heaven, and the Prince of God.
Hold that thought. Well, Dr. Stan, and Jonathan makes the point, of course, that Nimrod was executed for his heresies, and of course he wanted to be as a god, and they built an incomplete Tower of Babylon. You can actually go to Strasbourg today, where the European Parliament meets. They've actually reconstructed the incomplete Tower of Babylon. Why would you build a building as if it were incomplete? Because they understand, the European Parliament, people interested in bringing about a world government, understand the symbolism of what's going on today with the European Union, the United Nations. The average individual doesn't, but of course Jonathan makes the point that it was Nimrod's wife, and I can never remember, I always called Semiramis, but Semiramis is another name, that's another pronunciation. And then, of course, she had a son, and so that there was sort of a trinity, an unholy trinity of Nimrod, who was dead, and then, of course, the wife and the son. And it was basically a dark counterpart of the holy trinity, which would be coming. But Jonathan makes the point that there were literally 300 prophecies about the coming of Christ, and they were certainly all through the Old Testament, of course, prophesying that the Messiah would come. But there was also the satanic forces in the world, of course, these people who worshipped Lucifer, who hated the idea that, of course, that God would one day come to rule the world. But you pick the story up, please, Jonathan, from there.
Thank you. Well, in particular, I think the most marvelous messianic prophecy was that of Daniel. The angel Gabriel came to Daniel, and he revealed to Daniel. In fact, Daniel was a captive in Babylon, the nation of Judah had been swept into Babylon, and many of them, of course, fled elsewhere around the world, and Jewish influence became quite a thing in many countries as far away as China and Japan. And meanwhile, Daniel's prophecy was given. Daniel was praying in Babylon. He was reading the book of Jeremiah, and Jeremiah had stated that because the nation had rejected the prophets of God, that they would be dispossessed of their land for 70 years, and the intention was that they would learn a lesson, that God, they themselves had drifted into Babylonian idolatry, following the heathen nations around them. And they worshipped God with heathen practices. And, of course, this is an abomination, and they had to be cured of it. And God is very, very merciful. He actually let them go into Babylon, which was the center of paganism, so that they would become so thoroughly sick up to their ears with the paganism around them that they would give it away forever, and they would never again go into pagan idolatry. And that was the reason for them going into captivity. And as it turned out, when they did get back to Jerusalem eventually, they were very, very strict. They went the opposite extreme. And idolatry was no longer the problem. However, Daniel, reading the prophet Jeremiah, that there would be 70 years accomplished in the exile, realized the time was getting close. And so he offered a prayer of reconciliation to God and confessing the sins of the nation and himself, and asking the Lord not to delay, not to defer the restoration. And then the angel Gabriel came to explain the prophecy, which is known as the 70-week prophecy, a prophecy that dealt with two subjects, one, Jerusalem, and two, the Messiah. And in that prophecy, an actual time frame was given from the date when the command would go to rebuild and to restore and to build Jerusalem till Messiah the Prince would appear. And it was spelled out so accurately, so precisely, that there was no doubt when the time would be near. And now, Daniel's prophecies, because Jews had been scattered everywhere, and the Jewish people were in communication with each other among the different countries, it wasn't long before Daniel's prophecies went everywhere. And we have evidence that in the reign of Darius Hystaspes, king of Persia, the Persians, of course, took over from Babylon when they conquered it, but Daniel survived as a very honoured person in the regime set up by the Persians. And in the reign of that king, Darius Hystaspes, the mystic Zoroaster served under Daniel. And I think we did touch on that, didn't we, Pastor Stan?
No, we really didn't.
Okay, well, perhaps it'd be of interest to our listeners to go into this. I think it's fascinating to me anyway. Zoroaster was well-versed in the sacred writings of the Jews. And when he saw the great, good, and wise Daniel attain such a height and dignity in the empire, Zoroaster craftily set out to adopt many features of Daniel's religion, even copying some of Daniel's visions, would you believe? And he's also believed to have conferred with Jeremiah. There are some records which do suggest this. And Jeremiah, of course, was the one we mentioned earlier who had predicted the exile. And it turns out that a number of doctrines from Daniel do reappear in the teachings of this man, Zoroaster. I'll just list a few. The one supreme God, the coming of the Messiah, the existence of angels, the fact that angels are communicators between God and man frequently. And he also adopted the teaching of the final resurrection of the dead and the judgment of all mankind. Now, that's absolutely remarkable, because here we have a sun worshipper adopting many Hebrew and biblical teachings. Now, he actually wrote a book called the Book of Abraham, and in that he placed some of the same observances about meat, clean and unclean, that were given to Moses 900 years before. and there were commands on the payment of tithes, on the ordaining of one high priest over all, and even in Zoroaster's writings there were references to Joseph, Moses, and Solomon in exactly the same way that they're presented in the Hebrew Bible. And like the Hebrews, although he was a sun worshipper, Zoroaster hated idol worship. So these concepts were all mixed up with his sun god, Mithra, and his fire worship. I find that rather fascinating.
Well, now, didn't he actually talk about this battle between good and evil, between light and darkness, between God and Satan?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. That's right. In the prophets, God, in the Old Testament, God reveals to these pagans that he is the one who has created everything, whether it be the forces of light or darkness, that when you withdraw light, darkness comes, of course, but God is the creator of light, and darkness is the absence of light. Zoroaster understood that, but he got it from the Bible.
And I think it's really so interesting. People point out, well, my goodness, you know, here you are 600 years before Christ is born, and you've already got all these stories. They're all there beforehand. I mean, Christianity was simply duplicating Zoroastrianism. Of course, Zoroastrianism was simply, duplicating the prophecies that prophesied the coming of the true Messiah.
Yes, that is so interesting. People today, I noticed that on the internet, Dr. Stan, there are people today who are saying that Christianity is a copycat of the old pagan mystery Christ. Well, it's the other way around. They ought to really get to know their history, because the truth of history is that there was a promise of the coming Messiah from the very first beginning, and that after the Babel, this prophecy was counterfeited or copycatted by the pagans, but it was a prophecy that was still going to come true in the person of Jesus Christ ultimately. The pagan Christ are only myths. There's no historical basis for any of them. You can't pin any time in history for any one of those Christs. There's only one actually who pinpoints in history, and as a matter of fact, not only is he in history, but he cut history into two sections, before and after his name. And he's the only one that emblazoned his name on the calendars of the world, B.C. and A.D.
Yeah, it really is so amazing, and yet, of course, everything is done today to degrade and deride Christianity, and yet certainly it was his life, his death, and his resurrection that marked the beginning of modern-day civilization. But go right ahead.
Yes. Now, it's interesting, Dr. Stan, that the religion of Zoroaster that he began to teach, although it's anti-Christian, it soon began to tell of Mithra. Mithra was the sun god. Mithra, the mediator between God and man, and of his visit to earth to defend the faithful, of his ascension to heaven, of the baptism that he instituted, of his second coming, and finally the restoration of all things and the unending reign of the righteous, just as the Bible does. Now, that is absolutely astonishing. But this started because of the influence of Daniel. And he admired Daniel, and he thought, I'd better bring in into my religion a lot of these elements, because it'll help my religion to be successful. And that's exactly what happened for quite a few hundred years. For about 600 years, Mithraism was to become the dominant culture of the Persians and the Parthian empires, and later on was adopted by Rome.
And of course, here you had your Magi, you had all these people who were involved with the mystery religions, and they were all tied into Zoroastrianism, and of course they were tapped into, I think, the secret knowledge. There has always been this secret knowledge out there, but it comes not from God, but from the dark side. And so Basically, remember the three, I don't have to tell you, but the three Magi came. Where were they? They were simply magicians tied into this, but they knew the prophecies. They knew the writings. They knew Christ was going to come, and they wanted to come to see the Christ child. People don't understand the relationship between so much of what we read in the Bible and the ancient mystery religions. Well, pick the story up from there, please, Jonathan.
Yes. Well, it was not only in Persia that Jewish influence spread into other religions. Jews, as I mentioned a little while back, they travelled in numerous caravans to other places such as India, Tibet, and even China. And this had the effect of disseminating the biblical books and teachings and the prophecies of the coming Messiah among all the inhabitants of Asia. And I guess there was a divine providence in that. In fact, it's not easy to find any spot on earth where the Jews had not settled. And in the 5th century BC, or rather, should we pinpoint this around about 595 BC to about 574 BC, Ezekiel gives a wonderful account of the caravan traffic with Tyre in his day. Now, Tyre, of course, was one of the city-states of on the Mediterranean Sea next to modern-day Israel, occupying an area in southern, what's today southern Lebanon. And the people of Tyre, of course, were very, very adventurous. Their ships went all over the world. We've actually had traces of them coming all the way down to Australia and New Zealand too, and to the Americas.
Well, now, were they really sort of concomitant with the Phoenicians, what we refer to as the Phoenicians?
Phoenicians, that's correct, yes. Okay. Tyre, Sidon, and their colony in North Africa, Carthage, and many other spots. Venice, the word Venice in Italy comes from Phoenice. That was a Phoenician colony that was established. So they also went to England, Britain, up into the northern, the Baltic states. They travelled the world. They went across through Indonesia, up into China. They circumnavigated Africa. The Phoenicians were planted, I do believe, right next to the land of the promised land of Canaan, because while the nation of Israel was given the gospel of the coming one, the ships of Phoenicia could carry it around the world, and that would have been perfect. We find this happening in the days of Solomon. If that had continued, it would have been great, but of course they went into apostasy and idolatry. But nevertheless, the Phoenicians did carry quite a bit of the news of the coming one where they went. And Ezekiel describes the caravan traffic with Tyre, which was similar to that of Confucius and Laozi and Gautama Buddha and Pythagoras. And astonishing and significant as we might consider this, within 100 years after the death of Daniel, the different religions, Zoroastrianism, began to flourish in Persia, Buddhism sprang up in India, and Confucianism in China, and all of them had borrowed certain elements from the Hebrew scriptures. Now, this is a period immediately after Daniel's prophecies began sowing the world with these electrifying conceptions about God. Now, as for the Jews themselves in exile, they were aroused to a pitch of enthusiasm by the prophecies of Daniel. Because, look, after all, Daniel had said that the coming of the Messiah was to come at a certain time, and he was to be a suffering mediator who would pay the death penalty for man's wrong. And that was an electrifying thought. He actually enlarged on the earlier prophecy.
All that thought, and Gersa, Jonathan's just saying that the exciting things about Daniel's prophecies were, of course, this Messiah was going to come, and he was going to pay the debt for man's sin, for man's wrongs. And of course, the Daniel's prophecies really became the ideas that permeated all the existing religions at that time, Buddhism, Hinduism. All of the ancient religions had at least some of these ideas put forward by Daniel the prophet about the coming of the Jewish Messiah. So please pick up the story.
Yes, it's interesting also, Dr. Steen, that Daniel's famous visions that were taken up by Zoroaster, there's evidence that in turn there was close communication between Persia and India, which brought the Zoroastrianism to the Hindu people. And it's it's known now that Buddha, Gautama Buddha, as he's known, and also the Hindus knew of this coming. And the Buddhist reform that was made later was based on the doctrines that Zoroaster brought to them. Now, until the time of Buddha, about 500 BC, now 500 BC is roughly around the time when Daniel would have been dying. Daniel lived right almost up to that time. India had been in the grip of what they called Brahmanism. But Buddhism changed the idolatry of Brahmanism, worship of millions of gods, to the worship of Buddha himself. One God. And its teaching is permeated with ceremonies and teachings which imitate the earlier religion of the Old Testament, even though it's steeped in a lot of paganism. We can see the traces that sort of came in and gave a little bit of a window here and there of truth. Now, we might then ask, did Buddha know about Daniel's prophecy that gave the time of the Messiah's appearance? Well, from my research, it does appear so. About 500 years, this is what Buddha said. He said, about 500 years after my death, a prophet will arise who will found his teaching on the great fathers. And when that one comes, believe in him and you'll receive incalculable blessings. So he was pinpointing the time of Jesus Christ and saying that a great one was going to come who had been known to all the ancient fathers. We can only look at Jesus Christ as being a fulfillment of that. Now, the same wave of influence continued into China. We noted that the Israelites did find their way to China, and as a matter of fact, it's notable that many of them were employed in important military posts in China, and some of them even became ministers of state, even provincial governors and professors in China. And there seems to be evidence that Confucius understood and profited from the Great Reformation that had taken place in Judaism when they dropped off all their idols because of the captivity. And so he introduced his new code of ethics from Judaism, and that was the teaching of one God, which the Bible had taught for centuries. And the Chinese people took to that one quite well, actually. It won favour. And Confucius also made a statement. He said, a saint will be born in the West, and he will restore the lost knowledge. So there was a little whisper of the coming one, the coming saviour. And it's interesting that Roman historians of the first century also bear witness to a worldwide expectation of a coming Messiah. I could mention perhaps in particular Tacitus and another one. Tacitus is probably the greatest Roman historian ever, that ever lived. And he speaks of the expectation of a Messiah. He also speaks of Jesus Christ after he was born and of his trial and execution and of the group of Christians that arose. And then there was Suetonius, who spoke of the expectation of a coming Messiah. And it's interesting that the Romans believed that this Messiah would be born in Judea. Now, why would the Romans expect that? And it was also known among many Gentile nations that it was to be the land of Judea where the great Lord of the earth was to come. And this perhaps may have given an inkling to the wise men who followed the star that there was more to it than we realized. There was an expectation worldwide that a great one was coming about that time, and also that he'd be born in Judea. And around this time, we of course know, Jesus Christ appeared and Christianity began to spread worldwide. All of this information given to the Hebrew prophets, and particularly to Daniel, did help to pave the way for the coming one. So the Lord did his best to reach people long before Jesus arrived.
And that's really what's so exciting about the study of history, is you begin to see how it all fits together. But so much of this is never taught. They never tell you why the wise men came.
While the storm clouds gather all across the sea,
Jonathan, you go right ahead.
Okay. All right. Now, Christianity revealed itself all over the world very soon after the after Jesus came. And as a matter of fact, we have Paul writing in one of his letters that the gospel had been preached to all creatures under the earth. It's very, very interesting, actually, that I've been able to uncover records of the knowledge of the gospel coming not only to North America and South America very soon after it went to Europe and Africa and Asia, but even into the Pacific Ocean. The Tahitian people, when missionaries arrived in Tahiti less than 200 years ago, they found the Tahitian people had kept a record right down through their ancestry of an event that happened about 2,000 years earlier. And that was that great ships had come from the west. There were two tribes that were in a deadly combat on the main island of Tahiti at the time, and they looked out, and here was this great sailing ship with its great white sails. And from there came men who landed on the shore. As a matter of fact, both tribes were fighting. Suddenly the war stopped, the fighting stopped, because both of them were mesmerized by this unusual sight. It was just like a UFO landing in their midst. Here was unknown strangers coming from the west in a great ship. They came in a little boat, smaller boat, to the land, and then they started telling these natives of the great Son of God who had died and who had risen again, and that all men were equal. All men and women were now equal, and they must stop fighting. And so they did. And this is in Tahitian legend going back 2,000 years.
It's really amazing as you see all of this. But then, of course, there was all the forces that were at work. Certainly Christianity was here, but the occult influence was here, permeated every aspect of the world. But people were looking desperately for a solution to the problems and the violence and all of the things that were going on in the world. And here was a story of promise of a better life to come.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Stan, I guess Jonathan Edwards is simply pointing out that there was a story, certainly the story of Christianity, had spread far throughout the world. He gives many examples of that. You know, certainly hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before, we anticipate that the story was spread, and even into Tahiti, where their records tell about the great ships coming and meeting people, telling the Tahitian natives about the Son of God and why they should stop fighting. And it transformed much of what happened in Tahiti after this. This was several hundred years ago. But go ahead with the story, Jonathan.
Well, Christianity, of course, was revealing itself in many nations, and it became a conquering force upon the hearts and the minds of many people. And let's go to India, for example. Now, India was under the grip of Hinduism and Buddhism, and although they had a small window of expectation and knowledge, they didn't really know Jesus Christ at all. But when Christianity began to spread and say that he had already come, and that he was the saviour of everyone who would accept him, year after year, decade after decade, it had an amazing success in India. And the story of the birth of Jesus coming in human flesh was winning hearts everywhere. Now, when Christianity was introduced into India in the first century, and Thomas actually is credited as being the one who landed there, and one of the other disciples in the year 52 AD, travel was frequent and easy. In fact, we have a record that 120 great ships sailed for India from Egypt every year. Now, that's about 2 to 3 ships a week were sailing from the Bible region across to India weekly. That's not bad. And so there was a lot of travel going on, apart from the overland travel. And in the succeeding centuries, numerous Christians poured into India from Persia and from Mesopotamia. And a detailed history actually exists today of Christianity in the East. It's been well preserved by the Persians and Assyrians. And these were people who were writing in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, as describing the spread of Christianity. And all over the land, an increasing number of strong Christians began to rise up. And I'm focusing here on India for a moment. It's interesting that Marco Polo, the great Italian explorer, would later testify that in his time there were 6 great kings and kingdoms in the heart of India, and 3 of those were Christian. The other 3 were Mohammedan, Muslim. So a transformation had taken place by the time of Marco Polo, and Marco Polo reported that the greatest of all the 6 kingdoms in India was a Christian one. So the news coming to India concerning Jesus was by no means a trivial incursion. Now, you can imagine how the Hindus and the Buddhists would look upon this. The news coming was big news. And by 600 AD, the Brahmins woke up with a start. And they realized that these new truths were snatching their power from them. And they figured out that they'd better come forward and put an end to this crisis once and for all. So they did something. It was like another Semiramis counterfeit, a big-sized one. They realized they needed to accomplish 3 things. First, they must invent a god of their own that entered a human body. Second, they must give this counterfeit Christ a name similar to Christ, with similar events in his life and similar teachings. And thirdly, they must arrange their chronology to coincide with Hindu astronomy, to throw the date of this fabricated god back about 600 years before the time of Jesus Christ, so that they could claim precedence over the Christian religion. Now, since they already had thousands of existing gods, it would not be too difficult to find one whose name sounded a little bit like Christ. And the deity they settled upon from among their supply of gods that they already worshipped was the god Krishna. And having made the selection, they then drew up a special body of literature to teach this new ideas and to push it back 600 years into the past. And for a long time, this fraud succeeded. And I noticed there are still people on the internet who think that Christ has come from the Hindu Krishna. It's just a copycat of the Hindu Krishna. Well, the fraud was detected after about 1,200 years, around about 1,800. The similarity between Krishna and Christ was long noticed, and Indian priests were claiming that Krishna's incarnation was before Christ. And they loved to boast that the New Testament was fabricated from Hindu epics. And then in 1825, a sharp-minded researcher by the name of John Bentley solved the mystery. And from the Hindu Brahmins, he obtained knowledge and information that this had just been an invention. And today, Bentley's findings are pretty solidly set, that Krishna was chosen from among all the Hindu gods because of its sounding close to the name of Christ. But of course, that's not a good argument, because the name Krishna means all attractive. But on the other hand, the word Christ comes from the Greek word Christos, which means anointed, which is derived from a word krio, which means to smear or rub from oil, by implication, to anoint. And this is simply a translation of the Hebrew Mashiach, anointed, which refers to a consecrated person, specifically the Messiah. So the similarity is very superficial, and of all the 600,000 gods of Hinduism, only this one, Krishna, shows a little similarity to the English word Christ, but make no mistake, the two names have different origins.
Well, anything to undermine or certainly challenge the Christian claims, go right ahead.
And of course, the name Mashiach was used in the biblical book of Daniel as early as the 6th century BC to denote the coming of the Messiah. And since the New Testament record of Jesus Christ was published in the universally understood common Greek language of the first century. I mean, Greek was a bit like English is today. Although people have their own native languages, they also largely speak English all over the world too. And Greek had that honour in the days of Christ. And so the New Testament ultimately was written in Greek, and the purpose was to reach all nations. And so the Greek word equivalent to Mashiach, meaning anointed, it was inevitable that the Greek, Christ, meaning anointed, would be used. So Mashiach in Hebrew became Christ in Greek, and the two mean exactly the same. So the name Christ was not borrowed from the Hindu Krishna at all. It was a direct translation from the Hebrew used by Daniel as early as the 6th century BC in the Old Testament. But if we wanted to probe, and perhaps it wouldn't hurt to do that for a moment, if we wanted to probe the origin of this Krishna god that the Hindus had, it goes all the way back to Queen Semiramis of Babel, no less. The Krishna legend is simply an Indian version of the Nimrod story. And it's interesting that Nimrod, descended from Ham, was Negroid in appearance, and the infant Krishna in the arms of Devaki is Negro-featured likewise. He's a black god in the Hindu pantheon. And the identity of Krishna certainly goes back to Nimrod. It has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. All right. The charge that Jesus' crucifixion was borrowed from the Hindu god that was crucified is also a lot of nonsense. I mean, I mention this only, Pastor Stan, because we read this on the internet. There are people putting out these stupid ideas on the internet and hoping a gullible public will swallow them. The fact is, there's no crucified Indian gods ever in any Indian mythology. It's a total fabrication by some modern person writing in English on the internet.
In fact, crucifixion really didn't come around until about that time in Roman history, did it? It wasn't a method of execution.
That is true, yeah. It was actually a Roman invention. Okay, well, I just thought that would be of interest to how the relationship between the pagan knowledge of Christ and the truth of Jesus Christ.
Well, it is fascinating, and there's so much there that really we don't learn, and this is one of the big problems. Most Christians don't understand the history, the history of the other religions as they relate to the true religion, which is Christianity. But go right ahead.
Okay, now we have some interesting developments when Christianity began to spread around the world. And let's go back to the Middle East now, to the Bible land. When we look at what was happening in the early days of Christianity, it was a threat to two religions, and that was the religion of the rabbis, the Jewish Sanhedrin, who rejected him, it was a threat to the paganism, which worshipped Lucifer direct. Perhaps it would be of interest to look at the development of Christianity within the Jewish community, because I think this is really crucial, and a lot of our dear Jewish friends I think would be very surprised to know this kind of history being kept from the people normally. Now, we've got a development taking place in the early centuries. Oh, in the first century, and it leads to a big hoax that was perpetrated upon Judaism after Christianity began to spread. And the ordinary people today are generally unaware of it. Sadly, the history of early Judaism has been misrepresented to the Jewish people by standard Jewish literature and, or we could say, by their rabbis. Now, although most rabbinic literature has mischaracterized first century Judaism as being almost totally Pharisaical, the truth is that the religious situation in the first century was one of great flux. There were actually 6 or 7 different groups struggling for ascendancy within the Israeli Jewish community. And most of these were represented on the Sanhedrin, the council. Now, the representation initially did include also the so-called Nazarenes, or those who believed in Yeshua of Nazareth. Then came the Roman siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. And we know the prophecy that Jesus gave in Matthew 24. He told them this was going to come, and he said, get out when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. You get out. Run for your lives quickly. You won't have much time to go down to your house and pick up your goods. Just go. And I always find this fascinating, a wonderful prophecy, because it was given about 40 years before the event, before the event in AD 26, there was a siege of Jerusalem. There had been a revolt against something that one of the Roman leaders had done. The Roman army came down from Syria. They surrounded Jerusalem, just as Jesus predicted. But then for some unknown reason, they withdrew. Now, you can't flee when you're surrounded. And Jesus knew that. He gave the prophecy, he said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded, then get out of the city. Well, how could they? Well, we're told by history that for some unknown reason, Cestius's troops withdrew when they just about had Jerusalem in a stranglehold. They withdrew for no apparent reason, according to the historians. And the Christians saw their opportunity because they had been told to look for this opportunity. And not one Christian escaped. And you can look at the Encyclopedia Judaica, Jewish Encyclopedia, and it admits that the whole Christian population of Jerusalem escaped safely across the Jordan River to Pella. Now, at the same time as the Christians were running out of Jerusalem because they believed Jesus' prophecy, thousands of other Jews were swarming into Jerusalem because now it was war between the Jews and the Romans. And the Roman occupation came back soon, and the Jews that had flooded into Jerusalem were now trapped. They couldn't get out. In fact, they didn't want to get out. They thought behind the walls of Jerusalem they'd be safe. That's why they went there. And that went on for 3 or 4 years until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And while no Christian lost their lives because they had accepted the prophecies of Yeshua, virtually no one escaped who had been in that city. They were either slaughtered or sold into slavery. And I think it was something like 1.1 million people died in that siege of Jerusalem. How sad.
It was. It's a great, great tragedy. But this has been a recurrent, really, down through the ages, these mass numbers of people being slaughtered. We find it difficult to believe and understand that some of the things we're seeing today are simply a replay of what's happened time and time and time again throughout history. So the Christians were able to escape from Jerusalem. We know that John and Mary apparently went up to Ephesus, somewhere along in that area. At least that's as the story is told. But go right ahead.
Yes. You know, about the only person who got away, the lead Pharisee, Rabbi Jochanan ben Zakkai, was able to fake his own death, and he was removed alive from the city during the siege, and he was able to reorganize the Sanhedrin at a place called Yavne on strictly Pharisaical ground. Now, about 20 years later, AD 90, his successor, Rabbi Gamaliel II, in order to drive the Nazarenes out of the synagogue, because they were numbering about 20,000 to 25,000 Christians were worshipping in the synagogues in that region, and to drive them out, he added what became known as the curse against the Minim meaning heretics. And this was added to the 18 benedictions that were recited at every authorized synagogue. Yet despite this, it seemed impossible to curb the growth of the Christian movement. We go forward another 40 years into the 130s after Christ, 130s AD. And this was the boldest move of all, to get rid of Jesus Christ and to destroy the growth of the Christian movement. Rabbi Akiva, who's known as the father of the Mishnah, He attempted to answer the Christians by promoting a new, a non-Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Scriptures into Greek. And when this was read, it was found that he had ripped out key words in the Messianic text that were specially used by the Christians to demonstrate Jesus as Messiah. Imagine that. No Jew had previously mutilated the Scriptures at all because they considered it God's word. But here's a rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, who actually tore out key words in the Messianic text.
All that thought will be right back. Could not use them. Go right ahead. We've got 3 minutes.
Could not hear them being taught.
We've got 3 minutes for this segment of the program, so you go ahead, and then we'll take over, and then we'll come back right after the beginning of the next hour. But go right ahead. We have about 2.5 minutes now.
Okay. Well, this boy was pretty thorough. Akiva chopped out not only some of the text out of the Old Testament to minimize the Messianic evidence, but then he went to the calendar, and he chopped out at least 160 years of known Persian history. And why did he do that? Because the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9 had given 490 years prophesied, during which Messiah must appear. And by chopping out 160 years of history, that would mean that the 490-year prophecy was not completed in the time of Jesus Christ, but it would reach into the second century, into their own day. And then about 4 or 5 years later, around about 140 AD, Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta, and he was one of Akiva's main disciples, he codified and mutilated Jewish chronology in his book, which he called the Seder Olam Rabbah, Book of the Order of the World. Now, this book cuts out about 60 years between Adam and the birth of Abraham. It cuts out another 17 years between Solomon and the consecration of the Second Temple in 515 BC. But it cuts out a whopping 164 years of Persian history between 515 and 70 AD. Now, the true history of Persia goes on for much longer than that. The true history of Persia was, it lasted from 538 BC when the Persians took Babylon, down to 331 BC when Alexander the Great, the Greek, defeated Persia. So there's 184 years of Persian history. But the falsified history reduced the 184 years down to 24 years. Now that's what this Jewish rabbi did.
Well, I'm sure anything appears to undermine Christianity, because I'm sure that they must have recognized, even reading some of the prophecies like Isaiah 53, that obviously the Christian faith was real, and yet of course it undermined their power and their control over the Jewish people. And we'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan Gray, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest, of course, is Jonathan Gray, and we're going into the history that really every Christian should know, and very, very few Christians are ever taught. And this is why I thought that Jonathan's information is really so fascinating. And he's talking certainly about the how many of the rabbis would actually change the dates and remove parts of history, anything to undermine a belief in Christianity, because, of course, if Christianity is true, then, of course, the Pharisees and Sadducees' view of the Gospels was wrong. It was really all about power. I believe there were dark forces working within the Pharisees and Sadducees, dedicated to the destruction of this new religion, this new fulfillment of Jewish prophecy, this religion of Christianity. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. Now, incidentally, I'm not a pastor. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon, but I like to look upon what we do as a ministry, because we're trying to get people to understand we're involved in this spiritual battle being fought on a political an ideological and cultural and financial and educational battlefield, but this is a spiritual battle that we're engaged in today until we understand that there are powerful spiritual forces behind everything taking place politically, why nothing really makes sense. So if you are out there in the listening audience and you agree with me, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Remember, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and I've been so fascinated listening to Jonathan, I haven't let him get any information out on his ministry. Jonathan, how could people get in touch with your ministry?
Well, Dr. Stan, they can come, thank you for asking, they can come to www.beforeus.com, B-E-F-O-R-E-U-S.com, and they can also email me. They can join my free newsletter, which I'll send out once a week online. It's all available there on that website, beforeus.com.
And, of course, we carry one of your major books. What's the title of that one?
Dead Man's Secrets.
Dead Man's Secrets. We actually carry that book. But Jonathan has some of the most amazing DVDs. In fact, somebody had sent them to us, and that's how we became acquainted with Jonathan Gray, who, of course, followed the path of Ron Wyatt, who we interviewed before he passed away, and we're fascinated by Ron Wyatt's work and his work with the True Mount Sinai, the Red Sea Crossing, the Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, fascinating material. And of course, Jonathan has followed on so much of this, the true location of Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, we've had what Ron and Jonathan said, actually verified by the gentleman who is our producer this evening, who was fortunate enough on a trip to Israel to be taken to the true Sodom and Gomorrah. I've been there to Israel six different times with expensive tours. Never once did they show us the certified locations of Sodom and Gomorrah. But I was fascinated that Sir Jonathan had been there. In fact, he spent a night sleeping in one of those cities that were a little concerned because of the scorpions there. But Jonathan has some of the most wonderful stories and wonderful DVDs, and we recommend his material to you. And certainly we do carry his book, certainly on Dead Man's Secrets. So that's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You'll be fascinated by his weekly emails. All sorts of information you're not going to get through regular channels, but information that tends to validate the authenticity of the Holy Scriptures. So once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. We encourage you to go there to watch our DVDs, to listen to our radio programs, to read our newsletters, and then, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back here in just a moment with the second hour with Jonathan.